Welcome to this Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork. All who enter these doors are welcome. My name is Christina Epifania. I'm a worship associate, and it is delightful to see you here all today. We are a congregation that shares the pulpit with our minister, Nancy Arnold, who is at General Assembly this week. And as you all know, Nancy has served as our interim minister for the last 2 years and will be leaving us. So I hope you'll all be here for July 12th as we bid goodbye to this woman who has so wonderfully led us to our new minister and has helped us through the year. Today is going to be a wonderful service. After service, I hope you will join us for conversation and coffee. And if there is anyone new here today and you would like to receive our newsletter and would like to keep in touch with us, please, there is a person at the back, Anita, who will be, you will be able to take She will be able to take your name. She's pointing to me now at the welcome table. So we welcome you to our congregation. This has been a week that has seen incredible, incredible change in this country as one flag came down, another flag went up. Yes, it is the law of the land. So that some of us in this room, Ruth and myself, Ken and Stu, we can travel throughout the entire United States now and visit each other in hospitals. As other things as well. But that's very important when you're doing road trips at our age. And one other thing, my heart goes out, as I'm sure all of our hearts go out, to the people of South Carolina. And two, if you haven't heard it, a wonderful speech that our president made. And I'm not going to sing Amazing Grace, you don't want that. But he did say one thing. He said, yes, grace visited us and grace was put upon us. Now it is what we do with it. So that is a call to love for all of us. And as we listen to the wonderful talk that Ken is going to do for us today, Circles of Empathy, let's see if we can rise to the challenge that our president has given us. And now we will light the chalice. And now if you would open to hymn number 93, Stand As You Are Willing or Able. We're going, Maxfield is our wonderful musician today. He's going to play it through once, and then we're going to sing. Hymn number 93.
Turn.
now our first message will be delivered by Ken.
Actually, I decided in the interest of time, and since there are no kids here today, I'm not going to read the story, but I'm going to just show it to you because I love the book so much. This is a book called Misoso, and we bought this when the kids were young. It's African folktales. The story of Kindai and the ape is actually an African version. It's an Imomo Yokoyan tale of Androcles the lion. It's very, very similar, except instead of being a lion, they're gorillas, one has a thorn in it. What I want to show you is the art. This is art by a dear friend of ours, Reynold Ruffins, a very elegant, wonderful, gentle, older African-American man who lives in Sag Harbor. And he has done so many wonderful drawings for children's books. And I just want to show you, I'll show you who Kindai is. He is a brilliant artist, and we spent so much time just looking over his artwork on each of the day. Here is the ape. he's had a few exhibitions. If you were live in Sag Harbor, you know Kanpash. His drawings are often part of the Kanpash drawings. They're just so beautiful, so colorful, so rich. Oh, there's the ape attacking the house, getting the fruit. Here's the ape. After Kindai comes to get the ape back, he recognizes the one with the thorn. And there's the mother after getting the baby back from the ape. He's also a wonderful, wonderful human being, Reynold, and I love sharing his artwork.
If you would all please sit and let us have some silence, and then Ken will lead us in meditation.
Find yourself in a comfortable position. Let your feet be flat on the ground, your hands relax as you might. Let your heart and your lungs flow energy into all parts of your body. I'd like to try a loving kindness meditation. We're going to say four phrases three times, and the first time you'll be saying them to yourself. You'll be saying, may I be happy, may I be well, may I be safe, may I be at peace. When you say them, feel the warmth of yourself talking to yourself. Feel free to close your eyes while we say them. We'll say the fourth phrases three times. May I be happy, may I be well, may I be safe, may I be at peace. May I be happy, may I be well, may I be safe, may I be at peace. And this time, let's take a breath between each phrase. May I be happy, may I be well, may I be safe, may I be at peace. Now, in your mind, think of someone who has cared deeply for you in your life. Imagine that person. Think of how much you love them and how much they've loved you. Let your heart's warmth find that person. Wrap them in your arms. And now we'll say the same phrases, except may you be happy. And let's take a breath between each phrase, thinking of that person in your heart. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be safe. May you be at peace. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be safe. May you be at peace. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be safe. May you be at peace. Let's hold the silence for a few seconds. Let me first start with an image. Hurricane Katrina has just devastated New Orleans. Newscasters are interviewing survivors. A well-dressed white man is speaking to an old black woman who has lost her home. The woman is dressed in rags. She has no front teeth, a heavy Louisiana accent. She looks like a pathetic version of Mom's Mabley. Remember her? I find myself recoiling from her. She is an other, the kind of person who lives in a place that a hurricane will sweep away. She is sad, pathetic, not me. Then suddenly I'm aware of what I'm doing, pushing away. Suddenly I am angry. How is it that in my country a poor woman cannot afford front teeth? How is it that there, after all these years, poor black folks in rural Louisiana still live such marginalized lives? What kind of a nation are we? Then I'm angry at the news channel. Somehow it feels intentional that they chose this particular woman. The whole tone of the piece is looking down from a higher place onto this misbegotten class of hopeless souls. The tone is not outrage or even sympathy, but an almost pornographic voyeurism. It could be Biafra or Bangladesh, for all the connection we've made. That moment often comes back to me. How I pushed away this woman from my heart. Not only a fellow human being, but an American, someone who shared my national DNA, yet how easy it was to shut down. And this from someone who grew up in a mixed-race neighborhood with close friends who were black, who today has kids of African-American descent, I wonder if the newscaster's intent was not that I should feel pity, rather than empathy. Pity, at least in our modern sense, is from a distance, often mixed with disgust. Empathy is different. It could be you. With all the crises sweeping the globe, it is easy to see how we, mere humans, might want to shut down on caring about others beyond our immediate circles. What in the world can I do about kids playing in garbage slums in Manila, or mothers dying from Ebola in Liberia, or even black kids beaten up by police in Baltimore? The violence in the Middle East feels overwhelming, insurmountable. It is easy to think that no one cares about anyone, and that the violence will spin forever out of control. But I will argue that not is the glass more than half full, but it is filling rapidly in ways our ancestors could not imagine. One of my favorite American intellectuals, Steven Pinker, who also wrote a book called The Language Instinct. Have you anyone read it? Oh, I love that book. But he's also recently written a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And the startling truth that he lays out is that there has never been a better time to be a human being. The vast majority of humans live long lives without ever confronting a violent act. Let's ponder this happy truth. Looking at both the fossil evidence and the current experience of the remaining hunter-gatherer tribes, non-state small tribal groups must have been engaged in constant warfare. A man, apparently, had somewhere between a 20 and 40% chance of ending his life through most of human history at the hands of another man. That's a lot. If this ancient rate of death prevailed during the 20th century, a time of two major world wars, there would have been 2 billion dead of violence rather than 100 million. I imagine the lives of early Homo sapiens is not very different from a lion pride. The males would keep control for as long as they could, but eventually some larger or more powerful tribe would overwhelm them. All would be slaughtered, including the children, to get rid of the genes, right? Save the childbearing women. They would be the property of the new leaders. This, in fact, was exactly the description of the proper method of warfare 2,000 years ago, as laid out in Numbers 31 of the Hebrew Bible. I quote, "Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known man intimately. But all the girls who have not known man intimately, spare for yourselves." How inspiring. The Bible. Certainly there were moments of joy and peace therein among the trauma, as when the lions rested after a kill with no threats on the horizon. But not for long. Not for long. The Hittites or the Huns were over the next hill. Chaos often reigned with no central authority, and during times of chaos, it is smarter to destroy your neighbor before he can destroy you, which is exactly what happened in hunter-gatherer tribes, and also what happened in Iraq and Syria when things fell apart. Even in the relatively recent 16th century, human murder rates were astronomical, estimated more than 100 murders per 100,000 in Europe, 100 per 100,000. This plummeted to less than one homicide per 100,000 in the 20th century in Europe, with the rise of the state and national identity. Even our wars, in terms of proportion of deaths, are actually killing far fewer people, in terms of proportion. going from 65,000 deaths per conflict per year in the 1950s down to less than 2,000 per conflict per year in the last decade, a 90% reduction. So it sounds grim, all of this, but in fact, nowadays, most men will live into old age without ever experiencing a knife in the belly. And I am grateful for that. Most women will not only survive childbirth, but will never know rape. And most who choose to do so will stay with one mate for years, decades, in peaceful relations. What happened to bring this felicitous change? Pinker argues that we are not aware of it because we're so emphasizing the overreporting of violence. We know violence halfway around the world, whereas a woman in this, I know Tunisia, of what happened, what a horrible thing, and I think about it, despite all the peace that was happening at the same time. A woman in 16th century England would only know of the murders in the few villages around her. She faced far more violence in her true circle than we do. Violence in our immediate circle is exceedingly rare. How many people were murdered in Sag Harbor last year? None. Right? If it were in the 14th century, there would have been seven. But we witness more violence through our wider virtual circle. Pinker posits four main reasons for the astonishing decline of violence. The first is a gradual movement to centralize the use of violent force to an accepted state power, which is huge. Now, here in the US, we have higher rates of violence than the Europeans, partly because a major proportion of our citizens don't want to give up their guns to a central power. And I personally feel that's a legacy of the Civil War and a lack of trust in authority, because it's concentrated in the South. And we have to work that through. We really mismanaged the time after the Civil War. That's another story. Two, the second reason is life.
I'll put the microphone towards you.
Thank you. Life is perceived nowadays as no longer cheap. As we live longer and value our lives, we broaden this value to all human beings. Third, we've learned that cooperation and nonviolence can benefit both parties in the conflict. If I trade with you and talk to you, it's better than killing each other, especially in a time when technology has amplified the benefits of mutual cooperation. And then fourth, we are living in a time of expanding circles of empathy. Each century, each decade, the group that we consider us has broadened. Evolution has bequeathed us with a desire to feel empathy towards our immediate family and those who will continue our genes. That's here. The experience of empathy, this has been demonstrated with scientific experiments, actually makes us feel good. Watching other people taking care of others, sharing or doing good deeds, raises the level of oxytocin, the bonding hormone, in our blood. So it's something that, as mammals, it feels good to see and to help others when we can. The first circle of our immediate family is then expanded to include our tribe, our clan, and eventually unrelated allies, co-religionists, compatriots. Where we draw the line depends on our culture, our degree of contact with others, our life experience. We each know how certain events made it easier to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. For Stuart and me, becoming parents was a watershed. Stu recounts how he was on the Veatch Fund, listening years ago to a woman talk about the tragic death of her 2-year-old son in an accident that could have been prevented. He recalls feeling vaguely sorry for the woman. By coincidence, he heard the same woman tell the same story several years later when we had 2 toddlers at home. He said he could barely keep it together. So torn apart was he by the tale. We had kids. We could see what it was like. Her story had not changed, but his ability to place himself in her shoes had been transformed. I know that for me, having a black son has profoundly changed how I feel about events such as the shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland. That boy playing with a toy gun and shot within seconds as a police car arrived looked like my own son. But does that mean that a white parent of a white 12-year-old cannot feel the same connection, same emotions? Yes and no, depending on how much the parent has broken through the racial barrier that separates compassion in our country, which is real, and how much the parent feels their child could fall victim to the same event. I pondered the phenomenal expansion of gay rights in our lifetime. Woo-hoo! I vividly recall, because I am old enough, the widely held view of homosexuals in the 60s, and that's what we were, as depraved criminals or sick perverts. The stock line describing the seedy part of town was thieves, prostitutes, and homosexuals. Denizens of another world and not truly human. At that time, simply saying you were gay risked everything, a career, friendships, a life. Marriage was not even in the hope bucket. I was actually on Christopher Street, about a block west of the Stonewall, that fateful night in 1969, watching afar as young men tried to turn over a police van. We couldn't even imagine how much things would change. What happened? In 1984, I had a conversation with a friend, Tom, from business school, standing on a granite outcrop in Central Park. We were witnessing the first horrific wave of the AIDS epidemic, and I was despairing. Young men were dropping like flies, and no one seemed to care. To the contrary, many clearly seemed to believe we deserved it. Tom pointed out a huge silver lining to the catastrophe. That grandmother in Alabama or Georgia no longer believed that Jimmy was waiting for the right girl. All of a sudden, the discussion was launched, and out of the shadows, we all realized that silence did, in fact, equal death, and thousands fell, leapt, and were pushed out of the closet. Within a generation, every American had a cousin, neighbor, coworker, or child who was gay. Suddenly, the conversation changed when it became family. The circle of empathy shifted. We went from less than 25% supporting marriage equality in 1990 to over 60% today, and over 80% to people in their 20s, less than 25 years. I happened to be on my way to the Statue of Liberty with Layla a couple of days ago and some family from North Dakota, of all things, when the news broke out about the recent Supreme Court decision. As we arrived on that island, I looked up at this wonderful immigrant Amazon in the harbor, and I wept. Each generation expands the meaning of freedom as we grow our circles of inclusion. Isn't the Statue of Liberty the best symbol of the United States? I love that lady. A gift from fans. She's not holding a musket, she's holding a book and a torch, goddammit. And she's French. Vive la France. Actually, we met some French people at the subway, and I said, thank you. They were so nice. The expansion of empathy continues to grow, powered today by cosmopolitanism. Linkages such as travel and journalism, literacy and films that allow us to project ourselves into other peoples that our ancestors may have treated as subhuman. Mark Twain put it well in Innocents Abroad, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime. And I know we have some great travelers in this room. I'm looking at a few, so you know what I'm talking about. What can we do with the felicitous trend of broadening empathy? What can we do to encourage its momentum? One exercise is to constantly challenge ourselves to push these circles outwards, including to those who don't neatly fit in. An obvious group for me are prisoners. A recent article on the Norwegian prison system highlighted the failing of our own biblical approach to crime, seeing those who break the law as evildoers to be punished rather than as failed citizens. And I feel that. I feel that's a whole block of people that we need to think about differently. In fact, I am suspicious of the whole concept of evil. I've never liked it. Good and evil is a simple narrative. It satisfies our first-order thinking. I remember a folklore professor saying there are only 7 universal plots, such as overcoming the monster, boy meets girl, boy loses, etc. They perfectly reflect the key mythic narratives in our brain. So they're simple and they're good. They're first-order thinking. They help us react quickly. But these narratives, good for quick responses, may disrupt more careful analytical thinking. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn. And for us, Hitler was evil, the devil. It was that simple. Such a narrative never challenged us to think about why the Nazis did what they did, since evil is unexaminable. It was only years later that I read about the Treaty of Versailles, a vindictive eye-for-eye pact that would sow the seeds of many of the conflicts of the late 20th century, including those in the Middle East. It's something I would teach a high school class of what was wrong with the Treaty of Versailles and how it led to so much. I find myself today much more sympathetic to ordinary Germans. I certainly refuse to demonize white Southerners, as I did when I was younger. When I saw, actually, the film on Martin Luther King was one of the failures of the film for me, is these white Southerners were really not treated sympathetically, and they were also victims. A British friend told me that the far more enlightened Marshall Plan after World War II could only have happened because the Americans were more removed and therefore could shift to second-order thinking in reaction to Germany's defeat. If it had been the British and French again, we would have had another Treaty of Versailles. Thank God we did not. It was a turning point in European history, as you have told me, I remember, right? After 9/11, as someone who knew the Middle East fairly well, I would sometimes dare to venture that there may just possibly have been reasons behind the attacker's anger. I was immediately branded a traitor and a turncoat. I understood, of course, that in the passion of the moment, this was treading dangerous ground. But some of us have to stop and think, at least some of the time. Our relations with the Arab world are particularly painful to me. Having spent so much of my life there, the Arabs are very, very clearly within my own circle of empathy. But in my lifetime, I have seen a strong and clear demonization of Muslim Arabs in our nation because of historical events which are often of our own making. Men like Muammar Gaddafi, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Yasser Arafat, Saddam Hussein, they took on Hitlerian reputations in this country. But who in America has ever heard of West African dictators or Southeast Asian dictators or Latin American? You probably can't name them. But those guys have mythic proportions. Were they worse? I don't think so. I think we allowed ourselves to demonize the Arab countries in a way that no other region was demonized. A whole religion was characterized as preternaturally violent by people of Christian history, which is a pot calling a kettle black, if I ever heard one. This demonization not only pushed Arabs out of our circle of empathy, but created a subconscious or even conscious circle of antipathy, easily allowing bombs to fall, casual violence, and no tally of body counts. I saw the play Five Presidents last night in Bay Street, which was quite interesting. It's a fiction involving the five living presidents at Nixon's funeral. Have you seen it? As at one point, each president tallies the number of American soldiers dead under his watch to the individual. I wanted to shout out, but what about the Iraqis? What about the Libyans? Are they not men? The current mess in Iraq and Syria brings me to the same place. I lived in Syria and have spent time in Iraq, and I can't help but empathize with what the different players may feel. An angry young man slits the throat of an American in the desert, and I hear our calls of outrage, a need to lash out and destroy. But I know all the outrages in the other direction. The drone attacks, the thousands of children killed, the destruction of the weapons, our weapons are brought. So although that act of violence horrifies me, I can at least try to sympathize with this young man's horrific act, try to see what drove him to this terrible point. Would I ever commit such violence? I've been lucky in my life to never have experienced the trauma that might lead me down that path. Yet I know that I have capacity for violence. For example, my extremely intricate imaginings of a shoulder-fired missile to take down some of those goddamn helicopters that destroy our peace over the weekend. I am very detailed. Out this, where would I hide the missile thing after I got a few of them? In the woods. And really, I have these fantasies. But a relatively organized society has taught me the many benefits of peaceful negotiation. Plus, I have a genuine belief that my peace and quiet is not worth the lives of a few wealthy commuters, even obnoxious ones. But a young Sunni who has survived the ravages of the past decade in Iraq may not share this luxury. Rather than bombing him and his friends out of existence, which will only lead to more such angry young men, I'd rather talk with him and truly understand what is it that he wants. I may not agree, and it may not be possible to satisfy him, but it's a place to start. When I worked with the Palestinians, I found that I began to see the Jewish settlers as evil, with their segregated roads, their looming, threatening settlements, and their greedy theft of water. I decided this was not a useful feeling, so I arranged through a Jewish American friend to visit a settlement for Shabbat dinner. As I entered the home, anxious, I said to myself, "You're going to like these people," and I meant it. And I did, of course. I saw their humanity. I grew up in Brooklyn, for crying out loud. I knew the Shabbat back and forth. I understood why they felt the way they did. I felt their fear. They had literally lived in Fort Apache and had never met an Arab in the 10 years they had been there. Did I agree with them that God had given them the land that the Palestinians should be expelled? Of course not. And I spoke my own truth. But the interaction felt positive to me in that, for one, I let them know respectfully that many Americans did not share their views, including me, and that realization might temper their actions. I shared some of my own reality about their Arab neighbors, which I think was useful. At the same time, I came away with no desire to harm them at all, but with a sharper picture of the challenges and therefore a more clear-eyed view of possible paths. At the end, one woman, a more enlightened intellectual, told me she wanted to visit me in Ramallah, which I thought was a great victory. I told her just wear the Arab shmata, not the Jewish shmata. She never came because we later learned it was illegal for Israeli Jews to visit Ramallah, but the thought counted. Do I expect each of you to have a newfound empathy for Islamic State fighters or Ebola victims or black boys in St. Louis? No more than I do for any number of human tragedies that are far too great to comprehend. Feeling empathy does not necessarily mean caring in the sense of doing something. We are all pretty overwhelmed just managing our lives, thank you. But what I think empathy does do is it gives us the capacity to speak up and to speak out where we have the power and interest to do so. We may not have the material or spiritual energy to respond to every earthquake ripping at the planet, but if we at least respond in our hearts with empathy to those perhaps few situations we are able to respond to, it does make a difference. We will often find that we are not responding to just a specific instance, say the shooting of Tamir Rice, but rather to a systemic wrong that, with enough public outcry, will force change, whether it's police tactics or arms sales. Memes like Black Lives Matter do matter. We are becoming more and more one living, breathing mass of humans who share ideas, including ideas such as Not in My Name or Love Wins. The arc of justice may respond slowly, but it does respond, as we have seen this week. Think of the magic of this week. My favorite cartoon was the one of the Confederate flag coming down and the rainbow flag going up. Now, if the Confederate flag truly represented only South versus North, it would be no more offensive than Yankees versus Dodgers. But for most, it did not. It was white versus black. And finally, even South Carolina saw such symbolism as no longer acceptable. It took the lives of innocents in Charleston to push righteous Southerners to over the edge, but it happened. I can't tell you how wonderful it felt to see my many rainbow profiles on Facebook that day, including and mainly among straight friends. The day equal marriage came to our land, thousands of small voices singing together, expanding the circle. When I gave my talk at Bay Street on the Middle East, I asked those who told me that it touched them what they took away from it. Two themes repeated. I really felt your love for the area. And I think seeing empathy in someone else is at least partly contagious. And I came away feeling it was more complicated than I had realized, moving from first-order thinking to second-order thinking. Our world is indeed getting smaller. It is also getting less violent and more peaceful. Every day. It is getting less violent and more peaceful every day. Alhamdulillah, thank God. If we keep our hearts open and our minds awake, this wonderful trend will only continue. I know that the people in this room share a spiritual tradition that encourages, even requires, that we expand the circles of empathy, each in our own way. When fear strikes, we stand on the side of love. This line from our mission statement guides us. It is not always an easy thing to do, but we know it is the right thing. I'd like to end with a prayer by Thich Nhat Hanh called Call Me By My True Name. Please call me by my true names. Don't say that I will depart tomorrow. Even today, I am still arriving. Look deeply. Every second I am arriving to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone.
I I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that is alive.
I am a mayfly, metamorphizing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird that swoops down to swallow the mayfly.
I am a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am a grass snake that silently feeds itself on that frog.
I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant, selling deadly weapons to Uganda.
I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving.
I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands, and I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people dying slowly in a forced labor camp.
My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom all over the earth. My pain is like a river of tears, so vast it fills the four oceans.
Please call me by my true names so I can hear all my cries and laughter at once. So I can see that my joy and pain are one.
Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up and the door of my heart could be left open, the door of compassion. We're going to sing now hymn number, 159. This hymn always makes me cry because the theme is so close to my heart. You can love your country and love another.
Maxfield will play an introduction and we'll come in.
We extinguish the chalice here, that it might glow gently in our hearts. May it light your path as you leave this place. May it guide your way until we are together again.
And before we hold hands, I just want you to notice when you go out to the table, there is a cake there with the rainbow flag. It came from Aubrey and Beth and Pizza.
If everyone could please make sure you're touching someone, reach out. Okay. I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. Blessed be.